Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name's Claire Clark. I'm one of the hosts of the channel, and I'm here today speaking with Jeremy Snyder about his wonderful new book, Exploiting Hope: How the Promise of New Medical Intervention Sustains Us and Makes Us Vulnerable. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Claire.
I wonder if you could begin our interview by telling us just a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm trained as a philosopher. I did my graduate work at Georgetown University, focusing on applied ethics. And I'm originally an American, grew up in Kansas and did all my schooling on the East Coast. But the last 10 years or so, I've been a professor at the Simon Fraser University in British Columbia in their Faculty of Health Sciences. So focusing much more on public health ethics and medical ethics.
And how did you come to write Exploiting Hope?
So this is something that I've been kind of circling around really since graduate school. So for my PhD thesis, I did a project looking at exploitation in general. So this is something where I had been originally, even before I got into philosophy, really interested in international affairs and international business and politics at that kind of level, and really involved in some political advocacy as well around sweatshop labor, for example, and international inequality. And so I found sort of a hope for my PhD thesis where I would sort of develop a theory of exploitation. And for that, even I was really inspired by some of the folks I was working with at Georgetown, where we had the opportunity to work with a lot of bioethicists and other people. And I developed a sort of mentorship relationship there with an academic who's working at the National Institutes of Health, also in Washington, D.C., Alan Wertheimer. And he wrote a book on exploitation called Exploitation, which is essentially kind of kicked off a lot of the careers of several academics, sort of examining what that concept meant, but looking at it from the idea of not necessarily kind of the old Marxist sense of exploitation, where it's a lot of a particular theory of labor and tied up in Marxist economics, but more for some of these particular relationships that you might have that are not necessarily coercive, and even in some cases beneficial, but nonetheless might strike you as unfair or, as he put it, exploitative. And for me, that kind of hooked onto what I was seeing in sweatshop labor, where these might be jobs that are pay better than any of the other options that the people might have. So if you might be coming from a small village in Southeast Asia, the existing options are something along the lines of, working your village's farm or your parents' farm for basically subsistence wages, but you actually get a much better life and a much better opportunities by going into sweatshop labor. But I think a lot of people have been trying to articulate why, okay, so that's that seems better, but maybe not good enough or not what, so to these people. So I wrote a thesis that stood on the shoulders very much of Alan Wertheimer's work on exploitation, but tried to develop my own account of what exploitation is. And when I started this new job at Simon Fraser University, I was taking a focus much more on public health ethics and not in a philosophy department anymore, and where there are some pressures to write more clinical research and get grants and have sort of faster turnaround time. So I did a little bit more work with the idea of exploitation, but started doing work on very specific topics like medical tourism and health worker migration, these sorts of things. And more recently, in the last couple of years, I've been really interested in the development of unproven medical interventions. So these would be people who sell stem cell treatments that haven't gone through FDA approval yet, oftentimes selling them abroad in, you know, Mexico or Panama or where have you, that might have looser regulations. And to me, that kind of brought me back to the idea of exploitation, where a lot of times these people are, making a promise that this will lead to better health, a lot of times taking advantage of really vulnerable and desperate people. And it seemed like me an opportunity to both get back to some of those older questions of exploitation, but also by this time I've been promoted up to full professor. Some of the pressures of, doing lots of short-term projects were off, and I had a chance to kind of reflect on, you know, is there a bigger project I wanted to take on? So it seemed like a really good moment to try to write a book and really get into this idea of what is it about, especially unproven medical treatments, that is distinctly exploitative.
Well, I'd like to ask you a little bit about how the book starts, because it does, and reading the book, it does strike me as like a sort of straight bioethics book, bioethics, you know, rooted in the philosophical tradition. But at the very beginning of the book opens with a few different literary and artistic references that to me recalled medical or health humanities. So you quote Emily Dickinson. You've got a lovely image by Gustav Klimt. You give us an example from John Steinbeck. Can you tell us about one of these and why you chose to open the book this way?
Sure. Yeah. So this comes out of some of the training I got in grad school, where my thesis advisor, Maggie Little, did a lot of work on this ethical approach called particularism. And the idea of that is just basically that, you know, we can have general ethical rules, but there are really limits to how far those can go in telling us how to lead our lives. And a lot of ethics comes down to the context that you're in or the particular of the situation. And that can tell us when to follow the rules, when to deviate from them. And when I was being trained and working with her and the folks that she was sort of inspired by, they would often, you know, appeal to literature and art and, you know, these sort of really rich examples that can provide that context. So instead of, you know, philosophers will do these kind of thought experiments, you know, if you've watched The Good Place or, you know, you've come across these trolley problems and, even in Alan Wertheimer's work, as just referencing, you'll get these really kind of unrealistic examples where, you know, deciding whether to murder five people or one person with the trolley is supposed to generate lots of ethical truth. And I think there's some value to that. But the idea is that you miss a lot of how ethics actually works in real life if you don't provide context. So by looking at, I start the book looking at a lot of news articles about how people talk about exploiting hope. And the idea of using literature here is to try to add some emotional depth and some detail to it. So with the image I took for the cover, for example, this image by Gustav Klimt called Hope 2, It's something it's by chance owned by the National Gallery of Canada, and I've had the opportunity to see it in person, but it's something I've sort of had seen online many times before, and it really captures, it's kind of a duality that I'm trying to get at in the book, that I want to take seriously the idea that hope is important and valuable and wonderful in so many ways. And you see that with the famous Emily Dickinson's poem as well, that hope is a thing with wings and valuable and important. But a lot of what's going on with the idea of exploiting hope is it also makes you vulnerable. So in the Klimt painting, it's the image of a pregnant woman. I think, all that promise of the future and what may come and the joy that people often get with the prospect of starting a new family. But I think probably a lot of parents will recognize this as well. It's also a really terrifying time. And in the background of the Klimt image, you have a skull and various death heads and monsters. And to me, it sort of evoked the idea that with the hope also comes that vulnerability and that danger to loss. And I think that, certainly I've, as a parent, experienced that fear. I haven't had that loss, fortunately, but certainly with an early pregnancy or when you're just, entangled with a loved one and open yourself in that kind of way, it creates that danger too.
Absolutely. And so the book is really, is organized in a way where it's divided into two parts. So the first half, you really break down what you mean by exploiting hope and how what you mean when you say exploiting hope differs from other popular and historical accounts. But then the second half does provide that detail and that context, not in the form of thought experiments, but in real life cases, like participating in phase one clinical trials, stem cell research, right to try legislation, and crowdfunding. So starting at the beginning, what is your definition of exploiting hope, and how is it different from maybe the popular or common ways that this idea might be thought about?
Yeah, so the kind of simple version of my account of exploiting hope is that it's to take advantage of another person whose hope for the future or potentiality has been entrusted to us. So the idea of entrustment is really key. So the idea is that when we become sort of entangled in a relationship together, that I can take on certain or be entrusted with certain aspects of your well-being or your future. One way you can react to that is to carry out your duty to look out for that element of the other person's well-being, or at least not take advantage of it. And another approach is to see that as something that is entirely for your is an opportunity for your own benefit. So it's that do you take advantage of that particular vulnerability or not? And how that differs a bit from, I think how, so I definitely wanted to stay close to how people use exploiting hope in real life. So I don't think it's very valuable to come up with a theory of something that is internally consistent and viable, but is wildly different from people, how people actually use the word, right?
Right.
So I think the trick is to add something, some insight to that phenomenon or kind of behavior that people have identified in the real world, but be able to illuminate it a little bit, not simply repeat it. So sort of looking at, particularly in the press and the literature, how people have used that idea of exploiting hope, and especially that image of the snake oil salesman or whatever, it seemed kind of limited in how typically it's the idea of that you're taking an advantage, that it is something that rests on a lie or deception or coercion or something like that. So it is the snake oil salesman where they say, this is going to cure your cancer, you know, this is going to make your life better, knowing that, in fact, it won't do so. And I think it's easy to grasp why that's morally problematic, because you're lying to another person. You're mm-hmm. you know, ripping them off in that kind of way. And I think that is, in fact, true in many, many cases of exploiting hope. But what I wanted to do is take that insight that Alan Wertheimer had that I was talking about earlier, that in fact, in a lot of cases of what we call exploitation, it's not necessarily that you're just lying to somebody or coercing them or what have you, but that this moral wrongdoing can take place in a context where everybody is open-eyed about it, or at least it's not the intention of the exploiter to lie to the other person or rip them off in this kind of way. So the idea of not doing what you ought to do in light of the entrustment relationship that you've been given a responsibility to protect the other person in some sense, that goes beyond it a little bit. So one way you can do that, sure, is by lying to them, by just taking advantage of them. Other times it's just to not go far enough to actually look after them and help them out. And I think that was also seen in some of the examples I saw in the press. So when I talk about a little bit, this isn't a medical case, but you'd often see the idea of exploiting the hope of migrants, that these people who were shuttling economic migrants to Europe would sometimes abandon them or put them on unsafe ships or what have you. And those were cases where they weren't lying to them necessarily, but they were taking advantage of this desperation to leave their own countries and to get safe, and not doing enough to actually, that once you enter into that relationship with something, somebody, you owe them a duty of protection that they weren't fulfilling in those cases.
So the book makes the point that exploitation can actually, and this is a kind of a counterintuitive argument, that it can be voluntary and mutually beneficial. How is that possible?
Right. So a lot depends on how you're reading the idea of being voluntary. So it's not to mean that it's purely without pressures or what have you, but I'll go back to the sweatshop example to illustrate this and maybe talk about a few other examples. So in the case of somebody who really, really wants to work at a sweatshop because they don't have any other better example opportunities, or you know, Wertheimer gives the example of somebody who is in a sinking ship and is very, very happy to see somebody show up who can rescue them. You're faced with a choice in those kind of cases. You can drive a hard bargain where you can get whatever you can out of the other person, you know, essentially, you know, sort of holding them hostage to their situation, or you can go a little bit beyond that. But there's a sense in which we want to, you know, the idea is that those kind of relationships are voluntary, and that if I'm the employer in a clothing factory in Bangladesh, employing people for the absolute bare minimum, I didn't put them in that situation. They might be fighting for those jobs and really happy to get them, and have gone to a lot of trouble leaving their home village to move to the bigger city where they can have those jobs, because it's a lot better than subsistence wages back home, and with the promise of famine and flood and what have you. So in that sort of sense, those relationships are voluntary. They have a lot of limitations to them, but you want to take, but the idea is to take seriously the idea that's it does meaningfully demonstrate what the individual wants, that they are showing some agency there to say, look, you know, these are the range of options before me, and I'm going to try to improve my life as much as I can, given the kind of structural limitations. So some people will take that and say, well, look, I mean, then there's nothing wrong with sweatshop labor or anything where there's a deal where somebody's not holding a gun to your head or threatening to make you worse off. And that's not quite right. We can say certainly that more is owed to that individual. And in the case of sweatshop labor, I think that we can take seriously the idea that there's something structurally flawed where people do have that range of choices, either possibly starve to death or take this really, really low paying job in dangerous working conditions for long hours where you're barely able to eke by, that we owe more to individuals than that. So that's essentially what Wertheimer tried to offer up in his theory of exploitation. He would say that the problem here is one of fairness, that when in the example of the sinking ship, if I come up to rescue you and say, you know, normally I would charge $100 to tow a foundering boat out, but because I see you're really, really desperate, I'll only do it for $10,000. That's something unfair about that, that you're taking special advantage of that situation to gain much more than you usually would. And so his sort of general approach is to say that exploitation is an example of unfairness. And where I differ from that quite a bit is to say, as I said earlier, it's really about that entrustment relationship, that you're taking advantage of somebody who is essentially under your protection or is particularly vulnerable to you. And sometimes fairness gives a good sense of what they're doing wrong. But more generally, it's something about the particular relationship and how those relationships really color it. But in both cases, it's taking seriously the idea that it is what the person wants, and it is something that's valuable to them. But at the same time, even in those situations where the person being made better off and is expressing really real agency there, you can do something wrong with that. You can press your advantage too hard, and that's at the heart of exploitation.
And so how does exploitation then, does it relate to structural injustice? Or how does it relate to structural injustice?
So I think it definitely does. Sort of my preferred count of exploitation, it's not something I get into the book in a great deal of detail. I do have a chapter on exploitation where I sort of pick apart these different notions. For the most part, I'm really looking at those one-on-one relationships between the exploiter and the exploitee. And so it's much more about how that individual presses the advantage. But what I think is that these are really tangled up. So sometimes it's a structural injustice that gives the person the possibility of pressing that advantage or gives them a lot more power in the relationship than they might have otherwise. So it can be structural economic inequalities that give somebody a lot more power over another person. It can be, more social and structural inequalities where maybe because of race or gender, or even because of the kinds of roles that people have that give them more power than they would in a fully just world, that's what gives them the power, you know, to press an advantage on another person or to receive a lot of benefit from them. So yeah, they're definitely tangled up. I do usually try to keep them a little bit separate in that I think that, you know, these are different. If I'm an individual, I can ask separate questions about, okay, what should I do in this situation? And then, you know, for this other individual, and then what does that mean for me as a citizen of a country or of a world to try to make the starting conditions a more just place. So in the example of if I'm an employer in a sweatshop, I can ask, okay, how much should I pay my employees? But I'm kind of hemmed in by an economic system where I still have to be able to make a profit and keep my business going. So then there are separate questions around structural exploitation about what I should do to try to address those structures. So I think they raise different questions, but they're very clearly interrelated in that they have a lot to shape the kind of relationships we have as individuals.
So I'd like to shift from talking about exploitation to talking about the hope. You argue that there is there's a rational component to hope. I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about what ways is hope primarily emotional or maybe even fantastical, right? Like rooted in the imagination or in fantasy. And then in what ways is hope rational?
Yeah, and that was one of the things that I really enjoyed about this project was I had done a lot of work on unproven medical treatments and on theories of exploitation, but I hadn't really dug into theories of hope before. So when I was looking at that, I was relying a lot on the work of others, particularly Adrian Martin and Katie Stockdale to a lesser extent, and sort of not trying to come up with my own account of hope necessarily, but to integrate the work that other people have done into this account of exploiting hope that I was trying to develop. But essentially, the idea is that, you know, at its very bare minimum, hope is just sort of having an optimistic attitude towards something that could happen in the future. And, you know, it can be an entirely rational and even beneficial attitude to take because, you know, hope does a great deal of good for us. And this is kind of the duality I was trying to get at with the Klimt image and the example of, you know, from Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck, of people migrating to the West Coast during the Dust Bowl. And this idea is that hope is a wonderful thing. It gives you optimism. There's a lot of evidence actually in the medical context. People who have been given either a terminal diagnosis or even, you know, been told that they have a very serious medical condition, having hope for the future is a little bit self-fulfilling in the sense that it can reduce stress and make people more likely to follow medical advice and keep trying to improve their health. It has that sustaining value that actually makes it more likely that they will survive or have a longer life or higher quality of life. So hope can be really, really good for you in that sense, just emotionally, but also just it has a biological function for us. I think, you know, so many people are struggling right now in this awful year that we're in the middle of in 2020. And having hope for the future, I know for me is really important that this is going to end, that, you know, the political environment might change, that the vaccines will hopefully come out. And having that engagement with the future is important. And the emotional aspect of that is that, you know, and this is something I really borrow from Adrian Martin, is that, you know, it's not just a cold calculating. I think that there's a 80% chance I'll get a COVID-19 vaccine next summer, and I really hope that happens. But it's to have the full force of it, it's a lot of imagining what that future is going to look like and having that emotional feedback loop. And, you know, for me, for example, you know, it's sure I've started to think, okay, when can I get this vaccine? What's that going to look like? And for me, I naturally get into the space of imagining going to visit my family in the States and, you know, to see them and to hug my niece and nephew and my sister and, you know, all this sort of thing. And it's to say again that it's really, yeah, you're engaged with a particular scenario and a particular future and what that feels like and what that's going to look like. And that really speaks to why it can be so good for us.
Is there a difference between genuine hope and false hope? Or do they work basically the same way?
No, I think they're really quite different. I don't think that you can always cleanly separate the two, but, you know, broadly speaking, false hope is going to be where you know, the most straightforward example of that are what I think a lot of people mean by exploiting hope, where people simply have a misunderstanding of what the likelihood of that hope for a future is. So if, for example, I hope that I'll get vaccinated in the next month, and I think there's a 90% chance of that happening because I heard a news story or read a, you know, a Facebook meme about that. That's just wrong. That's simply not true. So I'm basing that hope on something else. Or in the story examples, I take a look at the in the book. You know, if I in reality have pretty much a terminal disease that there's no prospect of surviving past 3 months for, but I hope that there will be, because I've been told that there's actually a 50% chance that I'll be cured by this thing I can buy off the internet. So I'm basing that hope off of a deep misunderstanding of the actual chances, or in some cases you might think that there's something special about you or your context that makes it more likely that, you know, you're a fighter, that you can beat the odds or whatever. And you genuinely believe that. So, you can certainly hope for, this imagined future where you might genuinely understand that it's incredibly unlikely. There's a 5% chance, but you find value in hoping for it anyway. And that'd be an example that you're not necessarily misconstruing what the odds are. You haven't been lied to. You're not lying to yourself. You really do understand it's a 5% chance, but you still find value in imagining what that would look like if you hit the lottery in that kind of case. And that for me would be an example of genuine hope where there's a sense in which, you know, imagining yourself in that position is a little bit misleading and that's incredibly unlikely, but you're going to go for it anyway because you find that really sustaining and it gives you a brighter outlook. And that's very different from somebody who just misunderstands or has been lied to about how likely that is to come about.
Sure. Let's move into talking a little bit about some of your specific cases and how these concepts kind of play out in those cases. How did you select the cases that you chose?
Yeah. So these were most superficially these were drawn from kinds of areas I've been doing some research in. Anyway, I had done some work. In my thesis on clinical research, and I've been very interested in stem cells, for example. And most recently, I've been doing some work on crowdfunding as well. So they were areas I was certainly familiar with and prepared to talk about. But for me, the specific chapters each do some specific work in understanding the idea of exploiting hope. So the first of the applied chapters is on clinical research in a couple of contexts. So very early stage one cancer research, where essentially you have cancer researchers who are just trying to establish what the maximum safe dose of a new potential therapy is. And there's very little to no likelihood of it actually being effective at that stage. They're really just trying to find out if it's safe or not. And there's been a good deal of evidence that that there's a danger for a lot of false hope there in that people with a terminal cancer diagnosis might misconstrue that as something potentially therapeutic rather than at the very, very early stages of research. And the other area in that context I look at is later stage trials that are being done in poorer communities where there's very little chance for them to actually get access to the treatment. So the primary example of that would be HIV vaccine research that's being conducted in countries where it's very probable that they wouldn't get any early access to that. Just because of their health systems being very underfunded. So those are areas I've worked in before, but for me, it really gets at, it becomes a good illustration of the entrustment piece that I was trying to push for in terms of understanding exploitation, where it really comes down to the role. So in a lot of cases in clinical research, there's a lot of confusion between, is this researcher my doctor? Are they here to take care of me? Or are they a researcher where they're trying to create generalizable knowledge, where they're trying to say, okay, this is an effective treatment that then can help many other people, though maybe not this particular research participant. And if I am working with you as your patient, that's a very specific role and a very kind of specific kind of trust where my physician needs to be looking out for my welfare specifically. But if they're there as a researcher, then it's a very different role. And the vulnerability is very, very different there. So it really gets, again, down to the idea that the context of the relationship matters a lot. So that was really the purpose of that chapter. If you go to the next one, looking at unproven stem cell treatments as an example, that's one where then it's less the specific relationship, but more the economic system that we have and the way that we provide medical treatments. So this is more of your classic case of the snake oil salesman, where there have been a lot of people selling purported stem cell treatments, as there always are with any new treatment. And around COVID-19 as well, we've seen a lot of these around hydroxychloroquine and some of the new treatments that have turned out to be, it seems like, effective, but also some of the ones that haven't been, that you get really big promises for that. And so in the stem cell area, you have these clinics all over the place in the US, but also internationally, that have found some loopholes in FDA regulations where they kind of sell these products and make big promises about them that really aren't backed up by the science. And that's an example of less a specific role, but where you have a specific regulatory system or a market-based system that creates that opportunity to create hope and then take advantage of it. And that's a little bit closer to the idea of structural exploitation, where if we had a different regulatory system, then that opportunity for exploiting hope would be much less, that they're taking advantage of those loopholes.
What about the right to try legislation?
Sure. So that turned out to be, so that when I was originally working on it, it was just something I'd seen in the air a little bit. It seemed really interesting. My interest was particularly around then how political systems can allow for exploitation and the role of the politician in particular. So if you're not familiar with Right to Try, that was a law that was passed in 2018 and signed by President Trump, who essentially it weakens the FDA a little bit to purportedly allow faster access to unproven medical devices and drugs. But in reality, it doesn't change the system too much. And it seems like hasn't actually given more than a couple of people access to these experimental treatments. And in practice, you know, when he was on the campaign trail, I didn't know this was going to happen at the time, but it turned out to be a big, at the time that the Right to Try law was signed, Trump was arguing that it would save hundreds of thousands of lives, which anybody who was familiar with it knew that that was incredibly unlikely to be true. And so that was sort of my starting off point to see how a political system, but also, you know, the role of politician can lead to exploiting hope. But it turned out with to be sort of a plank in his electoral campaign later on. And even with COVID-19, you would see, trying to speed along access to experimental treatments being a really big issue. So it turned out to have a lot of grip there as well.
And the last example is crowdfunding. And that is something that has always made me look kind of unsettled. There's always seemed to me to be something sort of deeply wrong with having to have your medical bills paid for by strangers you don't know on social media. But I'm not sure I would have had the vocabulary to call it exploitive. So could you talk a little bit about the last example of crowdfunding and how that fits in?
Sure. Yeah, that's one I really struggled with quite a bit, because I think I wanted to be really careful about how I framed that. Is that something where I thought that the crowdfunders themselves were exploiting the hope of other people, or was it something else? And I definitely settled on the something else, and I'll say what that is. But yeah, it's a tough thing, because yeah, you do read these. So that's an area of research I've gotten into more in the last couple of years, and I've read thousands of these campaigns in the medical area. And they're absolutely heartbreaking, and I find it really emotionally difficult to, I definitely have to pace myself, and I caution my students to really, when they're working on this area as well, to kind of take breaks as well, because there are people who are in absolutely devastating situations, faced with the choices whether to, get the medicines they need or make the payments on their house. And, people are suffering as well. And, I definitely want to take that very seriously. And in the specific area of unproven treatments, these are often people who have been, told that they are very, very sick and possibly dying, and they don't want to accept that. So they're looking around for anything to help themselves out. And so generally when I'm looking at that, it's not that the individual who's crowdfunding for, say, an unproven stem cell treatment, or, I've looked at a lot of people with stage 4 cancer who have been told, there's nothing we can do for you, but they don't want to accept that. They have that hope for a miraculous recovery, and so they're looking around for some new fad diet or a stem cell treatment or homeopathy or something that'll get them a longer life or maybe even cure that cancer. And so the primary source of exploitation there is much more what we saw in the stem cell treatments, where somebody who is intentionally lying or exaggerating, or maybe they're a true believer, but they're essentially putting a product out there that is based on a lie about how much they're going to be working. And in the crowdfunding, it's not that the people running the campaigns are trying to lie to the would-be donors or are even exploiting those donors, but they're becoming a central node in kind of a network of exploitation. So they sit between the donors and the people selling these products, and they amplify the volume of those appeals. They oftentimes exaggerate. So because the people selling these cancer cures, for example, might be legally on the hook for any claims they make, they often rely on testimonials and kind of winks and, vague language. But what you see in the crowdfunding campaigns is that they take that to the next level, where they make those implicit promises about efficacy explicit. Or, they just kind of make up numbers or whatever. Again, not intentionally that they're trying to mislead their donors necessarily, but because they're placed in this situation where they need to convince people to give them money, and that they've already sort of been drawn into this. So the point of that chapter is much more to say, we can get locked into these systems where it is a little bit more complex than simply a exploiter exploited kind of relationship, but you can have people who are intermediaries there. And social networks are a good example of how those can actually create larger networks of people who are drawn into that relationship of exploitation.
What strategies can we use to prevent the exploitation of hope or respond to it?
I think it really does depend on, and this is where it goes back to the particular or the context, that really does depend on what is going on or what the kind of exploitation of hope is taking place. When you have these networks of hope, like in crowdfunding, I think that, and I talk about this in the book, and I've done this in my other writing, there are particular things that crowdfunding platforms could do to flag campaigns that are misleading, or if they're for particular kinds of treatments or clinics that have been shown to be spouting off a lot of misinformation. So there could be particular roles for people who are sort of central to that. And then there are a lot of fantastic scientists and academics who work on misinformation in the medical realm who have a big role in that too. Around our politicians, you know, we can do more about making sure we subscribe to newspapers and, you know, and people who do all these fact checks. You've definitely seen that around some of the lies of politicians in the most recent US election. And you see that up here in Canada as well. I think that kind of fact checking is essential. And again, trying to do more work on improving the quality of news and information that people get. Around the stem cell treatments and all that, I think there are things that regulators like Health Canada and the FDA can do to make it harder for people to misrepresent information and to actually sell these products directly. So, you know, knowing the sort of structural elements in these specific areas that allow people to be bad actors, I think is really important, and that there are specific steps that can be taken. But I think there's also a limit to that. So, you know, for me, it's essentially that people have this entrustment with the welfare of others, and they choose to take advantage of it. We can try to change structures and regulations to give people fewer, you know, bad actors, fewer chances to do that. But at the same time, you know, we're always going to have that trust, and it's a good thing. You know, hope is a good thing in many cases, and having people that we rely on is central to human life. So there's no way to regulate away or to make the potential for exploiting hope or exploiting anything else impossible. It's more an issue of, you know, can we try to protect people where there are these really big vulnerabilities, but at the end of the day, you know, we have to rely on people to do the right thing.
Is there any difference between exploiting hope in relation to help and exploiting hope in relation to other areas like sweatshop labor, for example? When I was doing my postdoc, I taught a class called Quackery in Medical History. And the medical students, where they kind of came down on quackery was like, well, if there is no treatment, if there is no viable option, then there's nothing wrong with whatever you can give people that gives them hope. So, in a sense, like quackery was only really quackery if it was competing with some form of cure or treatment that had been proven effective. But if there was no viable treatment, then people were sort of like, should have the autonomy to do whatever, you know? So what do you think about, is there something unique about health in the case of exploiting hope? And what makes those instances in your case studies different from, say, sweatshop labor or other forms of exploitation?
Yeah, I think it's definitely distinctive in that health is distinctively embodied, and especially the kinds of cases I was looking at were much more at that, you know, people with severe health needs, often a terminal medical diagnosis where they've been told that there's nothing that mainstream medicine can do for them. You know, that's a situation where there's a potential cutoff to your entire, you know, it's not a how comfortable will my life be, who will I fall in love with, or, you know, will I, you know, or how will my life go? But it's more the question about how much longer do I have to live, and will that be a life entirely of pain and decline, or can I stave that off a little bit? And often with these kind of terminal diagnoses, it colors every relationship you have, but also just it's can be hard to avoid if you're going to be spending the rest of your life in pain or hooked up to medical devices or what have you. So I think that that's very distinctive, and also that trust relationship is very distinctive in that we're often putting nearly every element of our life in the hands of another person. And so there's a lot of potential for exploitation there. That said, I mean, it's of a kind, that the account I give is of placing our welfare in the hands of another. And we do that in many walks of our life. And the non-medical cases that I talk about are things, and how people have talked about exploiting hope in newspaper articles and that sort of thing include things like, putting your hands in the, your life in the hands of a human smuggler. And there it's also life and death, but also your life prospects in a very deep way. So it's not, necessarily worlds apart there. And then there are some more trivial cases, like, somebody who thinks that they're going to be the next great author, and they say that, and have a sparkling literary career, and they put their hands in the, their hopes in the hands of a kind of literary agent who's going to lead them on. It's a little bit more trivial, but it's deeply felt by the individual and does have a lot of possibilities for exploitation. So I think in the medical case, it's really just about that, the depth of that and the centrality to the person's life is what's really at hand there. And to your students, I would say, I get the reaction that quackery could seem to be harmless in some cases, but I think a lot of the cases I look in the book, these are people who are being led along. They're wasting a lot of money. They're wasting other people's money. They're losing the opportunity for palliative care or to, have quality time with their friends and family. So I definitely think even in these kind of cases, just beyond the, any sense of what's distinctively wrong about exploitation, it can have some pretty significant harms for the people who are being exploited.
I think that comes across in the book for sure. Well, Jeremy, we've taken up a lot of your time. I wondered if you could tell us what you're working on now.
I'm trying to work now. It's definitely a struggle lately with the pandemic and kids who are on and off of school and all the stresses of life and trying to be a distant professor with students that you don't get to be in the same room for. But definitely in the early days of the pandemic, I was doing a lot of work just trying to distill some of the ideas from the book into the context of COVID-19. But to the future, I am continuing to be really interested in this idea of crowdfunding. And I'm kind of building up to hopefully writing a book on that, looking at how this is a how it changes the idea of giving and is really puts some of the problems with giving relationships on overdrive around justice and privacy and some of the problems with even exploiting hope for unproven treatments I talk about in the book, but how that's a kind of distinctive practice I think we need to be deeply concerned about.
Well, Jeremy, that sounds like a really great project. I want to thank you again for taking the time to talk to us about exploiting hope.
Sure thing, Claire. Thanks for having me on.